Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, March 24th, 2024. I am your reader, Sharon Faldudo, and an article, front page of the Gazette, under the banner of Cancer in Iowa. In the first two installments of this four-part series, the Gazette investigates Iowa's cancer crisis and what the state is doing about it. Find the next two installments in next Sunday's Gazette. Cancer rates soar, but why? Researchers looking at a variety of factors, from alcohol to fertilizer, by Brittany Miller of the Gazette. As 7 months old, Devin Koss started to get fevers. A doctor reassured her parents, Scott and Brooke, that it was likely due to teething, but they knew something was seriously wrong when she couldn't move one of her legs without pain. They took Devin to another doctor who saw her pale skin and immediately ordered blood tests and x-rays. After the appointment, the family hadn't even been home for 15 minutes when they got the call. They needed to bring Devin to the 11th floor of the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital, the pediatric oncology unit. It was there that doctors told the family that Devin had acute myeloid leukemia, an aggressive cancer of the blood and bone marrow. Over the next 6 months, Devin spent 153 days in the hospital as she received 5 rounds of chemotherapy, enduring needle changes, blood infusions, and a weakened immune system. In January, she battled an infection that nearly took her life. "It's unbelievably difficult," said Father Scott Koss of Cedar Rapids, a systems engineer for a networking company. "We're sitting there torturing our kid day after day just to cure them, and it's just awful." Devin was one of 20,800 Iowans that Iowa Cancer Registry estimated would be diagnosed with cancer last year. This year, another 21,000 new cases may join the crowd, and 6,100 may die from the disease. Iowa has the second highest cancer rate in the country for the second year in a row, according to the 2024 Cancer in Iowa report, and has the fastest growing rate of new cancers. 2 in 5 Iowans will be diagnosed with cancer. 4 types of cancers are disproportionately common in the state, University of Iowa researchers have found, but the state still is digging to uncover why. In this 4-part series, the Gazette will explore what we know and don't know about Iowa's cancer rates. We'll probe the role agriculture may play, and we'll examine how cancer clusters are investigated in the state. And amid the dire diagnoses, we'll highlight efforts that Iowans, from lawmakers to individuals, are making to combat the disease. "Among its Midwestern cohort, Iowa is the clear leader in cases of new cancer cases," said Mary Charlton, University of Iowa epidemiology professor and director of the Iowa Cancer Registry. "Minnesota and Nebraska, the states with the next highest rates, both face increasing incidence of cancer, but at lower numbers than Iowa. Cancer rates are declining in Wisconsin, Illinois, Kansas, and Missouri." Charlton and her team of UI researchers analyzed which cancers are popping up more frequently in Iowa compared to the rest of the country. They found that the state has one of the fastest growing rates of breast cancer nationwide, even though mammogram rates aren't increasing. Most of the cases are early stage. They're most frequently found in urban areas, including around Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, and Iowa City. Breast cancer is estimated to comprise the biggest portion of overall new cancer cases in Iowa this year. Researchers are projecting around 2,900 new cases, which would make up 14% of all new cancer cases. Just under 400 residents are expected to die from the disease this year. Breast cancer survivors make up 22% of all cancer survivors in Iowa. Prostate cancer also is prevalent, researchers have found, particularly in the northwest and western parts of the state. Estimates say 2,850 new cases of prostate cancer may arise in Iowa this year alone, a count trailing just behind breast cancer. Around 18% of Iowa's cancer survivors battled with prostate cancer. "Both breast cancer and prostate cancer are increasing in the country," Charlton said. "They're just increasing faster and at a greater rate in Iowa." Lung cancer rates are declining across the U.S. as a whole, but in Iowa they're declining much slower. In fact, Iowa has shown the least progress of all states in reducing lung cancer incidence over the last few decades. Iowa is one of a handful of states where cancer incidence rates are rising. The question is why? That's what the Iowa Cancer Consortium is trying to figure out, said Charlton, its president. The nonprofit leads the Iowa Cancer Plan, an evidence-based guide to help Iowa communities prevent, detect, and treat cancer. It also gathers around 650 researchers, public officials, and other stakeholders together to work toward reducing cancer burden statewide. Different work groups focus on topics like cancer-related policies, screening and prevention, and rural cancer. Our superpower is that we are able to build relationships within the coalition that are then ready for activity and engagement when it's time, said Kelly Sittig, executive director of the Iowa Cancer Consortium. The coalition exists so that the people and organizations who are members can do their work bigger, better, and more collaboratively. The Iowa Cancer Plan includes a focus on risk factors for cancer. Some, like age and genetics, are unpreventable, but others revolve around lifestyle and behavior choices. An estimated 4 out of every 10 cancer cases are associated with preventable risk factors. Smoking and tobacco use, for instance, account for the majority of lung cancer cases in Iowa. Chemicals in cigarette and tobacco smoke weaken the body's immune system and damage cells. At least a quarter of Iowa adults currently use tobacco products, and more than a fifth of high school students currently smoke cigarettes or use vaping devices. Physical activity levels and diets also play roles in cancer risk. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention associate at least 13 cancers, or 40% of all cancers diagnosed in the U.S. each year, with weight and obesity. Just under half of Iowans achieve the recommended levels of physical activity, according to the Iowa Cancer Plan. Alcohol consumption is another cancer risk factor that's disproportionately high in Iowa, as the Iowa Cancer Registry focused on in its 2024 Cancer in Iowa report. The human body breaks down alcohol into a chemical that damages DNA, allowing cancers to grow. Alcohol can also manipulate hormones and mouth and throat cells, which increases cancer risks. Iowa has the 4th highest incidence of alcohol-related cancers in the country and the highest in the Midwest, which include cancers like oral cavity, pharynx, larynx, colorectal, liver, and breast cancer. The state's adult binge drinking rate surpasses that of every other Midwestern state and is 4th highest in the country. It's hard to say that alcohol in and of itself causes very many cancers, but it interacts with other risk factors and it certainly increases your risk for cancer, Charlton said. It's one that breast cancer is associated with, and we know that's a big area of concern in Iowa. When Maria Steele couldn't shake a cough and a heaviness in her chest in December 2019, she feared it was her heart. I used to work in the ER as a nurse, said Steele, 66, of Adel. A woman comes in with chest pain, you always think heart or stroke. Those are the biggies. But after multiple tests, doctors gave Steele, a trim, non-smoking former athlete, a different diagnosis. They told her she had stage 3 lung cancer that had metastasized to her brain and bones. Shocked, Steele tested her home for radon, a radioactive, odorless, and invisible gas that escapes from mineral deposits that glaciers left behind in Iowa soil. She found levels double the rate at which the Environmental Protection Agency recommends remediation. I had heard of radon, but I didn't know how prevalent it was, Steele said. She had a radon mitigation system installed in her home for about $1,200 and now undergoes targeted treatment for cancer while advocating for preventive steps, including radon testing. When you're in nursing, it's all about patient education, doing things that are healthy instead of treating disease. Radon breaks down into radioactive elements that, when inhaled, damage DNA in the body. It's the number one cause of lung cancer among non-smokers and the number two cause of lung cancer overall, according to the EPA. Iowa is the only state entirely in high-risk areas for radon, which stretch across the northern U.S. Radon is one of several naturally occurring carcinogens in Iowa's environment, including arsenic and uranium. Other environmental contaminants linked to cancer, like nitrate, pesticides, and per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAs, come from human activities. Residents can be exposed through the water they drink, the air they breathe, the food they eat, and the products they serve. Tying cancer to its cause is tricky at its best and impossible at its worst. It's unlikely that any one exposure is going to cause cancer, researchers stressed. More likely, it's a complex combination of factors. Still, investigating potential environmental contributors is an important piece of that puzzle. I don't believe there's one source or a couple of sources that are causing these very different types of cancers because the distribution is different for all of them, Charlton said. I just caution anybody in any role about jumping to conclusions that are not evidence-based. That shuts down conversations instead of starts them. Also part of this series, What Role Does Agriculture Play? By Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. Iowa is the number one corn-producing state. We also lead the nation in production of pork, eggs, and ethanol. But another state ranking has gotten more attention in recent years. Iowa has the fastest growing rate of new cancers in the nation and the second highest cancer rate overall behind Kentucky. Iowa's stubbornly high cancer rate can't be blamed on just one thing, but oncologists and public health researchers agree it's time to look more closely at Iowa's top industry to see how it might be contributing. If you did an aerial map of Iowa, we are, river to river and north to south, a bath of ag chemicals, herbicides, pesticides, fertilizers, nitrates, Dr. Richard Deming, a Des Moines oncologist, said at the Gazette's Iowa Ideas Conference last fall. We're not yet at the point where we can say what every single chemical that ultimately gets in our water supply or onto our skin causes, but when you look at the amount of ag chemicals Iowans are exposed to compared to other states, I suspect that we'll find that might also be one of the contributing factors. In a state where sports arenas blaze with fertilizer logos, the phrase "corn grows Iowa" is common, and TV and radio and nearly 15% of lawmakers are farmers, there's reluctance to pinpoint agriculture as a possible reason for Iowa's rising cancer rate without conclusive evidence. However, a growing body of evidence linking agricultural chemical exposure to cancer has caused cancer researchers, doctors, and survivors to push for action. Nitrate, a key ingredient in much of the fertilizer sold in Iowa, not only can cause blue baby syndrome, but a 2018 review of 30 academic studies showed a link between ingesting nitrate from drinking water and adult diseases, including colorectal cancer. Nitrate is found at potentially harmful levels in 1 in 20 Iowa public drinking water systems and more than 12,000 private wells in Iowa. When Rob Foe was running a small-scale vegetable farm and raising poultry full-time near Tripola, Iowa, he worked outside from sunup to sundown. He doesn't use pesticide, but his neighbors with traditional corn and soybean farms do. In 2020, doctors found a cancerous tumor in Foe's kidney. They removed the kidney in 2021, and Foe, 58, has been in good health since. But he thinks about chemical exposures, including an incident in 2012 when he was doused by a crop duster. I got this cancer because there was a confluence of events, he said. Some of it might be genetic, some of it situational, some of it might be what I ate or how I live, it might be exposure to pesticides. Who knows which of those things provided the tipping point? Foe has been working since 2020 with the Pesticide Action Network, an international group critical of modern pesticide practices. Farmers in general are healthier than the average public. Chalk it up to physical labor, or early bedtime, or a religious heritage that frowns on drinking too much alcohol. They also have a lower rate of cancer overall, according to a 20-year follow-up of Iowa and North Carolina farmers enrolled in the Agricultural Health Study. But for some types of cancers, prostate, lip, acute myeloid leukemia, thyroid, testicular, and periosteal, farmers in the study had higher rates than the general public. While nitrogen, phosphorus, and other nutrients are found naturally in soil, farmers over decades have added fertilizer, both synthetic and manure, to maximize crop yields. Iowa and five of its neighboring states, Illinois, Nebraska, Missouri, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, together used more than 20 million tons of synthetic fertilizer in fiscal 2020. The most recent year data is available from all states. Iowa and Illinois, the nation's top corn-producing states, which together produce about one-third of the nation's corn, are the biggest fertilizer users. These states also have more excess nitrogen washing from farm fields into rivers and streams. Iowa's estimated aggregated nitrate load is the highest of all U.S. states. Since 1950, human sources of nitrogen have increased substantially, creating a global surplus of nitrate and nitrite that supersedes natural sources by about 30%, said the EPA reported last fall, when it restarted an assessment of how nitrate consumed through food or water affects human health. Here are some steps Iowa could take. Share more information. The legislature could make it easier to study the volume of agriculture chemicals by allowing annual sales totals of pesticides and herbicides to be public information. Manure management plans, which say how much manure is applied on which farm fields, could be digitized so data experts could study those volumes holistically. Raise stakes on pesticide violations. Iowa fines few people for pesticide use violations, and a bill passed in 2021 that it will allow the state to fine farmers, not just commercial applicators, for pesticide drift hasn't been implemented. If you have a slap on the wrist, it's a signal you don't really think it's a problem, Foe said. Set a lower standard for nitrate in public drinking water. The EPA, which set the 10 milligrams per liter standard for nitrate in drinking water in 1991, has started a new review of research on how nitrate affects human health. It's likely a long and political process, but could result in a lower protective standard. Provide cheap or free water filters. Reverse osmosis systems can remove nitrate and other chemicals from drinking water. Under-sink models can cost several hundred dollars, so the state or counties could set aside funds to defray the cost for residents with high nitrate levels in private wells. And fund local efforts. Minnesota lawmakers are considering a bill that would provide a 99-cent per ton nitrogen fertilizer tax that would raise $3 million a year to health departments and counties with private wells with high nitrate levels. Turning to the Iowa Today and the Week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state under the heading In the News, Immigration Enforcement Bill passes. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds said she intends to sign a bill passed by Iowa lawmakers that would give state officials the authority to arrest and order the removal of immigrants in the country illegally. The bill, similar to a Texas law that has been locked in a legal battle, would allow the arrest of immigrants that entered the country illegally after previously being denied entry or deported. The bill has been opposed by a number of immigration activists who have argued that it's unconstitutional and discriminatory. Republicans, though, said the measure is necessary to address the record number of illegal border crossings under President Joe Biden. Earlier this year, federal lawmakers failed to coalesce around a border security bill proposed by Biden. March Madness tips off. Two Iowa men's teams and three women's teams made it to the NCAA tournament to kick off March Madness this year. Number 2 seed Iowa State won its first game Thursday, while number 10 seed Drake fell in the first round. In the women's tournament, the number 1 seed Iowa, number 7 seed Iowa State, and number 12 seed Drake teams played their first games Friday and Saturday. AEA bill bounces back. Iowa House Republicans passed their latest proposal to overhaul the state's area education agencies Thursday as Republican leaders tried to iron out disagreements over how to oversee special education funding and oversight in the state. The latest proposal would let Iowa schools keep their special education funding, but require them to spend most of it with an AEA. The bill also adds a 2.5% spending increase on overall school funding and would increase the starting pay for teachers to $50,000 over 2 years. Republicans passed the bill on a narrow vote Thursday, making it eligible for consideration in the Senate. The Senate must pass the bill to send it to Republican Governor Kim Reynolds for a signature. Eminent domain bill advances. Iowa House lawmakers made another attempt to regulate the eminent domain process as a vocal coalition seeks to stop the construction of CO2 pipelines in the state. The bill would allow individuals to go to court to determine a project's eminent domain authority during state regulatory proceedings. Iowa voters back Republicans. Republican candidates are preferred by voters in three of Iowa's four congressional districts, according to a recent Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll. In the first district, where incumbent Republican Marionette Miller Meeks is challenged by Democrat Christina Bohannon, voters preferred a Democratic candidate by a slim margin. Under the heading, they said, every student deserves a quality education that helps them reach their potential. By reforming the AEA system, empowering school districts, and improving oversight and transparency, we are committing to better outcomes and brighter futures for Iowa students with disabilities. They deserve nothing less. Governor Kim Reynolds, after the House passes the AEA bill. And this bill, in attempting to solve only one problem, risks creating others, fostering fear among immigrant communities, disrupting families, and potentially hindering cooperation with law enforcement. The ripple effects of this bill could touch every facet of our community life. Representative Sammy Sheets, Democrat Cedar Rapids, on the immigration bill. Under the heading Odds and Ends, Police Review Boards, a proposal to ban citizen police review boards will not move forward in the legislature after a key lawmaker said the bill needs more work. Five Iowa cities, including Cedar Rapids, have citizen-led boards that oversee police departments, and the bill would have prohibited those boards. State parks need renovation. Iowa state parks are in need of more than $100 million in repairs to update shelters, sewage, and other infrastructure. A report prepared by a former Department of Natural Resources officer found that there were health and safety risks associated with the failing infrastructure. Despite the needs, the DNR did not ask the legislature for any additional funding this year. Under the heading Water Cooler, Iowa Family Abuse, four members of a family from Ziering were charged with felonies for allegedly kidnapping and abusing an 18-year-old relative. The 18-year-old was so badly malnourished that he weighed 70 pounds when he arrived at the hospital, according to court documents. State E15 lawsuit. Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd dropped her lawsuit to force the sale of year-round E15 fuel after the Environmental Protection Agency approved it earlier this year. Iowa and other Midwestern states have been pushing for the agency to allow the year-round sale of the fuel, which currently is restricted in the summer. Turning to the Insight page, there is a guest column from John and Terry Hale, who own the Hale Group, an Ankeny-based advocacy firm. They write, Iowa nursing home industry calls the shots at the Capitol. We were recently asked to grade the 2024 Iowa legislature and Governor Kim Reynolds on how well they've addressed issues surrounding quality of care in nursing homes. Without hesitation, we gave an F. They failed to take quality of care challenges seriously and failed to act. failure began before the session when Republican leaders refused to respond to calls by citizens, advocates, elected leaders, and opinion page editors for legislators to do their job of oversight, to show concern and curiosity by investigating the ongoing challenges and horror stories in nursing homes. The failure continued when, on the heels of numerous news articles identifying abuse and neglect in nursing homes, Governor Reynolds didn't even mention nursing home residents in her condition of the state address. Failure was further evidence in how the governor's office responded to in-depth reporting by Clark Kaufman in the Iowa Capital Dispatch about the cozy relationship between nursing home lobbyists and elected leaders, along with the startling amounts of campaign dollars flowing to their election campaigns. The governor's spokesperson asked Iowans to believe the unbelievable, that there's no relationship whatsoever between massive campaign contributions, the easy and ongoing access to key leaders by influential nursing home lobbyists, and the decisions made regarding public policies and appropriation of tax dollars for the industry. We know the relationship is real. We've been in this arena for 18 years, seeing how the game of money and influence is played, and coming to clearly understand that the nursing home industry plays the tune that elected officials dance to. Failure was also demonstrated when the Republican majority ignored a series of common sense bills from Senate Democrats, led by Senators Claire Selcy of West Des Moines and Janice Weiner of Iowa City, that addressed many of the problems in depth. Failure was complete when Republican lawmakers in the Iowa House chose to kill a bill that would have allowed nursing home residents to place cameras in their rooms to document the quality of care provided. The death of that bill was a disgusting yet insightful demonstration of how things work at the Capitol. Lawmakers held hearings and displayed bipartisan support. The nursing home industry, which had pulled out all the stops in prior years to ensure the bill went nowhere, was applauded by elected representatives for working with them to move the bill forward. The industry was on record as not standing in the way. Then what happened? While no one in the legislature has been willing to say, our firmly held belief is this: the industry did stand in the way, using behind-the-scenes access and influence to ensure the bill died. 3 months of paying lip service but doing nothing for vulnerable Iowans. 3 months of protecting the business of nursing homes rather than the residents served by nursing homes. Nothing was done to address the underlying cause of the nursing home care crisis, the inability to attract and retain high-quality workers. Nothing to bring visibility to how the industry spends $800 million in appropriations of tax dollars each year. Nothing to require accountability for those poor-performing homes that continue to get millions of dollars annually to provide woefully inadequate care. Nothing to set minimum staffing levels in nursing homes, as is done in child care settings. Nothing to shift dollars away from nursing homes and toward what Iowans really want, to be served in their own homes and communities. Iowans deserve so much better than this. In the remaining weeks of the session, we challenge Republican legislative leaders and the governor to demonstrate that they care about and will act to improve the lives of nursing home residents. At the very least, they should revive HF 2317, the nursing home camera bill. If they don't step up, they will be unworthy of support when Election Day rolls around. We have a crisis in the quality of care in Iowa nursing homes. And so far in this legislative session, we've seen a crisis of lack of caring at the State House. There is also a guest column from about 30 superintendents, a guest column from a coalition of concerned superintendents. Superintendents call for a thoughtful AEA reform. As a coalition of superintendents from across Iowa, we are standing together at a crucial juncture for our state's education system and the students that it serves. As lawmakers still are considering reforms to Iowa's area education agencies, it is vital that we share our united perspective based on our diverse experiences leading districts both large and small, urban and rural. Our message is clear. We are deeply concerned about the proposed changes to the AEAs, especially the shift toward a fee-for-service approach. The value of the AEA system as designed is that it is a cooperative that ensures that every school district, regardless of size or location, has access to the services it needs to serve students. Rural school districts in particular rely heavily on AEAs for critical support. Disrupting a model that has largely worked over the past 50 years will have grave consequences for the students we serve. We also were worried about the timeline for many of the proposed changes, starting as soon as July 1st. Such haste in implementing fundamental shifts in AEA support service risks destabilizing our educational ecosystem, leaving little room for necessary strategic planning and adaptation. We believe our students and communities deserve better. Additionally, the move to centralize control within the Department of Education, which does not appear to have the capacity and has leadership that lacks the experience in education, undermines local expertise and decision-making, which are crucial in tailoring services to the unique needs of their communities. This proposal is an unnecessary overreach by our state government based on exaggerated claims about impending federal action that now has been largely debunked. Over the past decade, funding has not kept pace with inflation for our schools. and this has left us in a challenging position. The proposed changes might force us to choose between essential AEA services and hiring staff to meet immediate needs, a choice no district should face. Depriving schools of resources and then asking them to sacrifice critical services for their students is detrimental. Increasing state supplemental aid to 3% or higher and raising teacher pay are essential steps toward a stronger system that supports students comprehensively. The rationale behind the proposed AEA legislation was to enhance outcomes for Iowa students, especially those facing the steepest challenges. The intention to narrow the gap between general education and special education students is noble and necessary. Yet as we scrutinize the proposed changes, it's difficult to envision how this legislation will effectively achieve these aims. We acknowledge the need for improvements, which necessitate a statewide review of our educational system, including the Department of Education, our schools, and AEAs. This should be conducted with patience and inclusivity to identify areas for enhancement and devise strategies that uplift every student. We feel no legislation should be adopted until such a review takes place, and we advocate for a process that welcomes all voices, including those of superintendents and stakeholders still awaiting the opportunity to engage directly with the governor. Governor Kim Reynolds recently stated, "Elected leaders should always trust the people they serve, and I promise I would do it again." This statement should extend to education reform. While the intent to improve is commendable, it should not dismiss the collective wisdom and expertise of those embedded in the day-to-day realities of our schools. The majority of stakeholders, including us, has significant reservations about the proposed AEA legislation. Change, when guided by a comprehensive, thoughtful approach, can lead to meaningful improvements. However, such change must be approached cautiously, ensuring it builds upon the strengths of our current system rather than undermines them. Let's strive for educational reform that is inclusive, equitable, and reflecting of the diverse needs of our state, securing a bright future for all of Iowa's children. Another guest column from Tim Kemp, the mayor of Hills. Iowa City School Board refuses to meet with Hills community. The Iowa City Community School District Board of Education has refused an invitation to visit with the community of Hills. They instead invited community members to talk at the upcoming board meeting, where they would not have to answer any citizens' questions. As quickly as they are trying to push the closing of Hills Elementary, it's somewhat surprising they would even allow that. The district slogan of All In for All Kids should also add Except for Hills Students, but All In for All Kids Except Hills Students isn't quite as catchy. In 2021, Hills Elementary was nationally recognized as a Blue Ribbon School. The next year, after years of waiting, the Iowa City School Board voted overwhelmingly to build a new elementary school in Hills. 2 years later, they were recommending closing the school, leaving Hills as the only community in the district without a school. On February 26, district administrators informed the community and the Hills staff that they planned to close the school. The next night, they made that recommendation to the board and said they would vote on it in 1 month, giving the community little time to react and rally to support for the school. How did we get to this point? That is hard to tell exactly. The original plan was to build behind the current school, thus not having to move students. That idea was quickly pulled from the 5 presented options. They didn't want to build, they said, so close to a school that had kids in it, despite doing so in many other schools in the district. In another option, the city did not want to give up its park for 2 years by swapping land. The option to buy land never took off either. District officials said they talked to numerous landowners about buying land. They didn't. The other two options involved relocating students for 1 year while the new school was built. The district never bothered to pursue those options. When turned down for buying land, they just sat silently. The district said that without the loss of 60 students to vouchers district-wide, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So the loss of less than $500,000 and an average of 2 kids per building is causing the closing of a school? They mentioned the cost of educating students at Hills is more than other schools. Hills has a student body that is facing more obstacles than probably any other school, with high, free, and reduced lunch and English language learner numbers. That is why it takes a little bit more, and it has shown great results, as evidenced by the Blue Ribbon recognition. Yet if we had those 60 students back, this wouldn't be an issue, so cuts would then be made in other places. So why aren't those cuts being looked at? One board member wrote me, according to recent demographic studies, Hills is not growing to the extent its leaders thought it would 10 years ago. What? Since 2010, our population has grown from 700 to almost 1,000, a 35%+ growth, with most of that coming since a citywide water system was installed in 2015. It has grown beyond our expectations. We are growing as a community, not shrinking. Administrators said they did not come to this decision quickly, yet it was a surprise to staff and the community. When was the decision to close Hills first brought up? While they may not have come to the decision quickly, they are sure being quick about closing it. 1 month? We asked that the district keep Hills Elementary open, even if officials are not ready to build a new school. They were presented with other options to save the money. Why does Hills have to bear the brunt of their cuts? Closing the school would just be the most recent example of the mistreatment of Hills Elementary. Closing a school should be a monumental decision, not a knee-jerk reaction made in 30 days. We ask all community members in the district to contact board members asking that Hills Elementary not be closed. The district patrons and the students, staff, and community of Hills deserve better. And turning to the community letters and the editorial cartoon from a cartoonist Joe Heller based in Green Bay, a man and a woman approaching the TSA. The woman is a security. She's waving her wand over him. She says, "Anything to declare?" And he remarks, "Yes, why am I scrutinized more than the aircraft?" While a man sits at a desk reading a newspaper that says, "Boeing Safety, United Maintenance Concerns." The first letter is from John Carver of Decorah. Melting glaciers require revolutionary action. Wake up, wake up, the British are coming, the British are coming. Wake up, the glaciers are melting, the glaciers are melting. John Carver of Decorah. Next, Thomas Cook of Iowa City writes, Miller Meek's votes don't pass the smell test. Thanks to the Gazette for the March 20th article about the Department of Veterans Affairs expanding eligibility for those exposed to toxins and other hazards, including burn pits. And thanks to the VA for eliminating the phased-in approach through 2032 for enrollment. But no thanks to Representative Marionette Miller Meeks, who gave a speech on the House floor in 2022 claiming the PACT Act, or promise to address comprehensive toxics, was too expensive before she voted against it. She repeatedly says she is fighting for veterans every day. For a Vietnam veteran with a chronic lung condition, the differences between her words and her votes don't pass the smell test. They're breathtaking. Thomas Cook of Iowa City. Next, Frank and Susie McKinster of Marion write, Don't mourn its ending, be glad for the Caitlin Clark era. Rather than be sad that the end will eventually come, we should all be grateful for what we have witnessed. Coach Bluter, Coach Jensen, and their staff will have other great teams and other great players, but I can't imagine ever seeing the likes of a Caitlin Clark again. We have been so privileged. Frank and Susie McKinster of Marion. Next, Clark Beasy of Cedar Rapids write, I support ranked choice voting. I would like to support ranked choice voting. I'm several years away from being able to vote for our elected officials, but I hope that by the time I turn 18, our elections use ranked choice voting and are more fair and civil. Clark Beasy of Cedar Rapids. Next, John Kenyon of Iowa City writes, Cole goes out of her way to grandstand. It's a chore, but Althea Cole ought to read her own columns. She might be surprised to learn that protest, despite her assertion that it is not effective, seems to create a great deal of long-lasting discourse and awareness. Each time protesters point out the hatred, cruelty, and hypocrisy behind public policy proposals targeted at marginalized Iowans, Cole is there with a 50-inch column decrying such tactics in great detail. She does so again with a new thirst for activism for acquitted Iowa City protesters Sunday, March 17th. She would also do well to look in a mirror. She refers to that protester, Tara Dutcher, as a self-involved performer spellbound by the case's own song and dance, yearning to be the face of a movement for justice and beauty. This in the same column where Cole goes out of her way to point out that she respectfully declines to use Dutcher's preferred pronouns for reasons of conscience, despite writing around that word choice in a way that would have left few questioning whether it was intentional. There is no respect there, just a snarky footnote included only as a cruel bit of grandstanding from a self-involved performer who time and again goes out of her way to belittle and demean people who ask only to be treated with the same dignity and respect afforded others. John Kenyon of Iowa City. And Seth Williams of Cedar Rapids writes, While aid goes overseas, U.S. veterans' needs linger. I cannot support Ashley Hinson or vote for anyone willing to spend $14 billion in military aid to another country while our own veterans struggle with getting the help they need. It is absolutely owed to them above all other countries' military needs. It is sad and horrible to know the citizens of Israel are suffering every day in many ways, but our veterans should come first. Our veterans deserve a system that is there to help them with all their needs, be it their benefits, help with getting employment, or homelessness. Even just adequate health care would help tremendously. The VA system is as broken as our school systems are. That money could drastically improve our school system and would go a very long way toward our impoverished children and families. This country is rotting away, and those of you who continue to ignore and steal our own citizens' basic needs are disgusting and disrespectful to the very people who have allowed you to be in the position you're in. $14 billion sent somewhere else is 14 billion slaps to the faces of everyone who needs a helping hand. Seth Williams of Cedar Rapids. And some quotes of the week. Jeff Pomerant, Cedar Rapids city manager, announcing Google is planning a $576 million data center in Cedar Rapids. This is an exciting time for Cedar Rapids, the region, and the state. Next, Manny Galvez, a board member of Eastern Iowa immigrants' rights group Escucha Mi Voz, explaining the group's response to a bill that would allow local law enforcement to arrest undocumented immigrants. He says, from Texas to Iowa, our message is, no tengan miedo, we have no fear. We will continue to fight this unconstitutional law during rulemaking in the courts and on the streets. Then we have John Lorenzo, a fisheries biologist for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, after finding no living fish on a 50-mile stretch of the Nishnabotna River following a massive fertilizer spill. I've never dealt with a situation like this before. And David Downing, a former Iowa DNR official who issued a report showing state parks need $100 million in repairs. We're in dire straits. Everybody is afraid to talk. Nobody wants to say a word because you'll get your head handed to you. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, March 24th, 2024. I am your reader, Sharon Falduto, on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service, and we turn to today's obituaries. Gordon Wayne Wenzel Sr., 84, of Osage Beach, Missouri, was called home by the Lord on March 18th, surrounded by family. A visitation will be held from 11 a.m. to noon on Friday, March 29th, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. A graveside service will follow the visitation and begin at 12 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery, Garden of Eternal Love. Gordon joined the United States Air Force after high school and was stationed at Portsmouth, New Hampshire, as an aircraft mechanic. He was a lifelong member of the Four Square Gospel Church in Cedar Rapids. Gordon worked at Universal Engineering. He began a career as a charter bus driver and began working for charter coaches. In 1990, he moved to Missouri, where he continued to drive charter buses until he retired at the age of 75. William Emmett Kemp, known as Bill, age 93, of Marion, passed away Sunday, November 5th, 2023, at Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. Celebration of Bill's life will be held from 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday, March 30th, at the Marion American Legion Post 298, located at 625 31st Street in Marion. Private committal service will be held at a later date. Leland Carold Millard, age 85, of Clinton, formerly of Alburnett, passed away March 20th. A visitation will be held from 10 to noon on Wednesday, March 27th, at Murdoch Funeral Home in Marion, with a funeral service immediately after. The burial will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Leland proudly served his country in the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War. He retired from Rockwell Collins as a machinist in 2001. After his retirement, he worked at Advanced Auto Parts in Marion. Lee was a member of the Alburnett Christian Church. He was also a member of the Antique Automobile Club, and his passion was restoring Model A cars. Kelly Ludeke, age 59, of Norway, Iowa, passed away March 19th at the Gardens of Cedar Rapids. Celebration of life, 4 to 7 p.m., March 29th at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. Kelly worked for RSM McGladrey and Tanager Place. She loved to read and spend time with her family. She enjoyed helping her husband with the books at Auto Interiors and Convertibles. Mary Golden Brockmeyer of Cedar Rapids passed away on March 15th in Avon, Indiana, with members of her family at her side. She was 92. Mary was the college nurse at William Penn College in Oskaloosa, Iowa. She worked many years of nursing throughout her career, was on numerous boards, and won a number of nursing awards. She was always active in churches where she and her husband were assigned, and was an active member of PEO and DAR. Services will be held at St. Paul's United Methodist Church, 1340 3rd Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids, on Saturday, April 20th at 10 a.m. Doris Batcher of Lisbon, age 89, passed away on January 30th, 2024 at the Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha. Memorial service Tuesday, March 26th at 11 a.m. at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service of Mount Vernon. Visitation 1 hour before the service. Burial in Lisbon Cemetery with a luncheon to follow. Doris enjoyed sewing, playing the piano, reading, camping, baking, watching Lawrence Welk, traveling to national parks, hosting family dinners, and helping her husband with home improvements. She volunteered for Cub Scouts, campfire. She was a teacher's assistant and a Sunday school teacher for her church, United Methodist Church of Mount Vernon. Luann Craigle, age 91, of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, March 20th. Private family graveside services will be held in Guttenberg, Iowa, at a later date. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids assisted the family. A celebration of life for Larry A. Smith of Vinton, who passed at age 77, will be Sunday, April 7th, from 1 to 4 p.m. at Leonardo's Pizza Restaurant, 2228 16th Avenue Southwest in Cedar Rapids. Judy Bush, age 80, of Cedar Rapids, died at Mercy Hospital following complications from heart surgery on March 20th. Services, 9:30 a.m. Monday, March 25th at Bethany Lutheran Church, 2202 Forest Drive Southeast in Cedar Rapids, by the Reverend John M. Dold, with burial following at St. Joseph's Cemetery, Sisley Grove Road Southwest in Cedar Rapids. Friends may visit with the family on Sunday, March 24th, from 1 to 4 p.m. at TN Funeral Home, 3100 F Avenue Northwest, and on Monday from 9 to 9:30 at the church. Judy retired in 1999 after 25 years with Terracon Consultants in Cedar Rapids, where she performed administrative and human resources duties. Judy truly led a life of good works and divine service and was an example to other Christians. She was a 59-year member of Trinity Lutheran Church in Cedar Rapids, where she served in various capacities with the church's Lutheran Women's Missionary League, Accountancy Team, Funeral Luncheon Team, Lutherans for Life Group, and Bible Study Group. Mary Adele Hamilton, age 91, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on March 16th. Visitation 10 to 11 a.m. Saturday, March 30th at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Funeral service 11 a.m. Saturday, March 30th at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories, 11 a.m. Mary was a teacher in the Cedar Rapids schools. She was a member of Westminster Presbyterian Church in Cedar Rapids for over 30 years. She was also active in DAR and PEO. She was an avid bridge player. For sport, exercise, and a good time, Mary joined the Aquarelles, which was a group of women who did synchronized swimming. The group did floating patterns without arm strokes. They propelled themselves through the water without splashing or kicking their legs or feet. The goal was to create a kaleidoscope effect. Maureen Patricia Fozzi, known as Mo, and born Maureen Patricia McCluskey of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully in her home, surrounded by loved ones, on March 11th at the age of 63. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, April 5th, at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, April 6th, at the Cedar Memorial Chapel Park Chapel of Memories, and entombment to follow in the Cedar Memorial Park Mausoleum. Never desiring to be the center of attention, Mo was a selfless, empathetic, quiet, compassionate person whose tough New Yorker attitude never completely disappeared. Her wardrobe, home decor, and personality were vibrant, colorful, and begged for peace. She was passionate about music, football, coffee, her pets, and her people. David Leon Fauto, age 76, of Shellsburg, passed away peacefully at his home on March 17th. Dave joined the Army after high school graduation. During his enlistment, he spent a year at the North Pole as part of a scientific expedition. And from there, he was deployed in Vietnam, where he ran heavy equipment and performed other specialized tasks. Dave was a self-taught, skilled mechanic who enjoyed restoring his old Corvettes and exploring the beautiful open roads of America on his motorcycles. In his professional life, Dave worked several jobs before he began his career at Farmland Foods. He started in the truck repair shop, then became an over-the-road truck driver, and then retired as a dispatcher. After retiring from Farmland, he took on several other part-time jobs to keep busy and share his skills with anyone who wants to learn. A military service will be scheduled at a later date. Kenneth Eugene Erger, known as Ken, age 98, of Cedar Rapids, died March 8th at Northbrook Manor Care Center. Funeral Mass, 10 a.m. Friday, April 5th at St. Jude Catholic Church by Reverend Nick March. Burial, St. John's Cemetery. A vigil service will be held at 4 p.m. Thursday, April 4th at TN Funeral Home. Those not attending the vigil service may visit with the family on Thursday from 4:30 to 7 p.m. at the funeral home, and on Friday at the church after 9 a.m. Ken enlisted in the Navy and served above the USS Intrepid during World War II. His service exemplified bravery and honor and earned him the Purple Heart. Ken dedicated 40 years to working as an insurance agent, primarily as co-owner of Slavia Agencies, which later became First Iowa Insurance Agency. He was a member of St. Jude Catholic Church, where he served on the Finance Committee for 30 years and volunteered for the Sweet Corn Festival since its inception. He was a member of Knights of Columbus Council 5544 and Catholic layman. He was also a member of the Elks Club, American Legion, and VFW Local 788. He served as past president of the Cedar Rapids Association of Insurance Agents and the Cedar Rapids Life Underwriting Association. Ken was a founding member of the Thursday Noon Optimist Club of Cedar Rapids, and he volunteered countless hours at the Community Free Health Clinic. He was also part of the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library for many years. Daryl Vincent Wernemont, age 70, of Jacksonville, Florida, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away of a sudden illness on March 13th under hospice care in Florida. A celebration of life will take place at a later date. Daryl was sought after for his keen business sense, which benefited corporations such as Cherry Burrell and Floor Daniel, the Haskell Company of Jacksonville, and Daryl enjoyed a decade-long association. Daryl was known as a top-notch equipment marketing manager. David G. Williams, age 89, of Bloomington, Minnesota, passed away peacefully on March 15th. Dave served in the Army. Dave began a 37-year career in industrial metals with a position in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Working in various sales and management roles for Anaconda Brass and Vincent Metals, Dave earned the respect of both customers and co-workers. Dave appreciated a Scotch old-fashioned and a meal that someone cooked for him. He was happy to be on cleanup duty. He enjoyed a game of cribbage and a round of golf, especially the mid-round ginger snaps. Not one to brag, Dave was proud to have notched a hole-in-one in his home course in Minnesota. A private service will be held later this spring. Mary S. Wignall, age 70, from Lakeville, Minnesota, passed away at home on February 17th. Mary worked at FMC in Cedar Rapids and swiftly became their first ever female purchasing agent. Mary had a passion for life that was infectious. Her kitchen was always filled with the aroma of her delicious recipes, a testament to her love for cooking and family dinner nights. A celebration of life will be held at Legends Golf Club, 8670 Credit River Boulevard, Prior Lake, Minnesota, on April 27th from 2 to 4 p.m. Raymond C. Stark, age 82, of Fairfax, passed away on March 20th. Ray was a farmer with a homestead west of Cedar Rapids, living his entire life on the farm established by his ancestors, who were among the first pioneers of Iowa in 1855. Ray joined the Army in 1960, training in Fort Leonard Wood as a field communications specialist, and was an Army reservist for many years after serving his term. Ray's farm is located near the Said Rail Supper Club, a popular restaurant now closed. A classic car enthusiast, Ray had a beautifully restored 1958 Chevy Impala, the make and model of his first car. Ray enjoyed taking his car to auto shows, often winning Best in Show with his numerous trophies overtaking several rooms around the house. A private ceremony will be held celebrating Ray's life. His final resting place will be at St. Joseph, commonly known as Stark Cemetery, alongside his pioneer ancestors. Janice Carol Mitchell, born Janice Carol Sewell of Cedar Rapids, age 76, passed away peacefully surrounded by her family and loved ones on March 11th after a short battle with cancer from a brain tumor. Janice traveled the entire country most of her life, bringing different cultures and experiences to her children and family. She would say, "I am a gypsy." When she couldn't travel, she would rearrange her home for a new feel. She loved camping, gardening, and creating amazing sculptures from wood. Most of all, she loved her family. Often she could be found grabbing photos from Facebook and creating small video clips. Jan believed everyone deserved a second chance. She was also a Christian, believed in Jesus. Funeral and celebration of life services will be held on April 13th at 11 a.m. at Gospel Light Baptist Church in Marion. Evelyn Dolores Villetta, age 90, of Cedar Rapids, passed away March 19th. A visitation will be held Friday, March 29th, 4 to 8 p.m. at the Cedar Memorial Chapel Stateroom. Service will be Saturday, March 30th, 1 p.m. at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Evelyn worked at the nightlife and did waitressing in Shoeyville. She also drove limousine for the Cedar Rapids Airport. Evelyn was a longtime member of the Lions Club. She enjoyed attending family activities and sporting events, going to the casino, sewing, landscaping, playing the accordion, and puzzles. Vern Schott, age 71, of Cedar Rapids, died peacefully on Friday, March 15th, after a long battle with interstitial lung disease. He was good-natured to the very end. Vern held many jobs in his lifetime, ranging from armored truck driver to school bus driver. He spent decades in management at Armstrong's Department Store and New Life Fitness World, finishing his working careers at Gilcrest Jewett Lumber Company in Coralville as a crane operator. Along the way, Vern lit up the night sky at important events through his searchlight business, Sky Searcher Rental. Vern had many interests. He flew airplanes and ultralights, rode motorcycles, owned speedboats and Corvettes. He could strike up conversation with anyone who also had or wanted to have one of those things. A tribute to Vern's life is being planned, with details announced soon. Turning to the sports page, Mike Loss writes, NCAA tourney truly starts Monday for Hawkeyes. Holy Cross didn't bend the knee to Clark in Iowa. The College of Holy Cross women's basketball team played before an announced crowd of 127 at Stonehill College last November 29th. Little did those Crusaders, an apt name for a team of fighters, know then that they would go play before a loud gathering of 14,324 Saturday in Iowa's Carver Hawkeye Arena. Many in the capacity crowd paid Taylor Swift, Adele, or Olivia Rodrigo tour prices on ticket markets to see an NCAA tournament first-round game, with only about 127 of those people rooting for Holy Cross. Stonehill's Merkett Gymnasium, this wasn't. The Stonehill Skyhawks, the number 2-ranked Hawkeyes, aren't. Yet the Crusaders were no more daunted playing Iowa in front of all those Hawkeye fans and an ABC audience than they are by classwork at their 3,100-student school that touts rigorous, personalized education. "Gutsy group," said Iowa coach Lisa Bluter. The way that we played against a perennial power, the face of women's basketball, I can't put into words how proud I am of our fight, how we competed, said Holy Cross head coach Maureen McGarity. Her team took an 11-10 lead, fell behind 20-11, then drew back to within 23-21 at the end of the first quarter. Iowa pulled away, of course, for a 91-65 win, but the Crusaders played nothing like a 38-point underdog they were expected to resemble. Who was it raining in three-pointers in the last 1:33 of that period? That wasn't the face of Iowa women's basketball, Caitlin Clark, for a change. Nay, it was Holy Cross guard Bronna Power Cassidy of Dublin, Ireland. Power Cassidy called Iowa a phenomenal team and Carver an unreal atmosphere. But she also said, "We wanted to go out playing our style of basketball, play fearlessly, regardless of the stage." This was a Crusaders team that forced Clark into 6 first-half turnovers. This was 5'8" Holy Cross sophomore Caitlin Flanagan going one-on-one with 6-foot Clark in the paint in the third quarter and coming away with a basket. McGarity's Crusaders are Irish, at least in name. Another starter is named Kara McCormick. Meg Callahan is in the Crusaders rotation, and Mary Elizabeth Donnelly is a reserve. But Caitlin is an Irish name, too. Clark was the player with the most temper on display based on her glares and gestures to the game officials and her comments to them and herself. She had 27 points and 10 assists, so the planet didn't jump off its axis. But Clark admitted she wasn't thrilled with her slow start or her team's. "Yeah, I was a little frustrated," Clark said, "but I feel that comes from knowing what it takes to be where we want to be. From here on out, every single team is going to give us a really good game. I want to win, and I expect us to be really good all the time." Yes, the 16 seeds from Worcester were unable to hang with the Clark and her teammates for the duration. Clark's shooting eye wasn't at its sharpest, but her defensive eye was. She had 2 steals for lay-ins in a 30-second stretch early in the fourth quarter. It was a reminder to Holy Cross that it may have a great school, but the NCAA tournament is where a player who pitches insurance in nationally televised commercials always wins in a 1-versus-16 game. This tournament is hard. If you looked across the women's tourney Saturday, you saw higher seeds either behind or in unexpected scraps before pulling away. Number 5 seed Oklahoma trailed 12 seed Florida Gulf Coast by 10 points after a quarter, then won. Number 4 seed Indiana led 13 seed Fairfield by just 38-34 at halftime before its 89-56 victory. This was the Hawkeyes' rust shedder. Their real return to the hypertension of this tournament is here Monday night. Every single team is basically a top 25 team at this point, Clark said. Iowa's toughest game of its 4 wins in reaching last year's Final Four was its second-round home contest against Georgia, which almost had too much bulldog for the Hawkeyes. Getting a first-round foe that refused to roll over probably was a good thing for Iowa. Business, as philosopher Jim Ross has said, is about to pick up. CJA basketball news, Kirkwood makes the title game yet again. Freshman Jenna Tweed, a former Benton Community Prep, scored a game-high 19 points as Kirkwood downed Mesa 66-43 in the NGCAA Division II National Women's Basketball Tournament Friday night in Joplin, Missouri. The Eagles played number 1 seed Johnson County for the national title last night. In the semifinal, Kirkwood, 34-2, managed to hold Mesa to a season-low 30.2%, or 16-53 from the floor. The Eagles used a 15-2 run in the first quarter to turn a 3-point deficit into a 10-point lead. Freshman Lizzie Pua also finished in double figures for Kirkwood, scoring 11 points and grabbing 7 rebounds. Sophomore Demetria Pruitt finished with 10 points, and sophomore Kaylee Corbin added 8 points and a game-high 10 rebounds. In the time machine, a look back at the people, places, and events in eastern Iowa, Bucky O'Connor. He twice guided Iowa's Fabulous Five to the Final Four in the 1950s by Diane Fannin Langton. Frank Bucky O'Connor, head basketball and golf coach at the University of Iowa, was on his way to Clear Lake for a speaking engagement April 22, 1958. As he traveled along Highway 218, the car in front of him suddenly slowed and swerved to avoid hitting a pair of guinea hens in the road about 3.5 miles south of Waterloo. O'Connor swerved his car too and then lost control, skidding sideways into an oncoming semi bound for Cedar Rapids. Both vehicles went into the ditch. The semi's load of 16 tons of concrete sewer pipe and tile fell onto the coach's car. Authorities determined O'Connor, age 44, had already died from the crash before the pipes flattened his vehicle. His funeral was moved to the First Methodist Church in Iowa City to accommodate the number of mourners, including fellow Big Ten coaches and officials. He is buried in Memory Gardens in Iowa City. A native of Newton, the bespectacled O'Connor had played basketball at Drake University and coached high school basketball at Harrisburg, Illinois, and in Boone, Iowa during World War II. He served 4 years with the Air Force, some of the time in Japan, returning to Iowa in 1948 as the UI's freshman basketball coach and varsity golf coach. Lawrence "Pops" Harrison was the Hawks' head basketball coach at the time, leading the team during the war years to a .700 winning percentage and the Big Ten title in 1945. Harrison's health forced him to leave the sidelines in January 1950, and O'Connor took over as temporary head coach because everyone thought Harrison would return. Instead, Harrison was fired, and Raleigh Williams, the UI assistant athletics director, was named head coach in addition to keeping his AD job. Williams had coached the Hawks for 13 years before enlisting in the Navy in 1942, leaving Harrison in charge. Williams named O'Connor as his assistant coach, but then Williams, citing health concerns, stepped aside, and O'Connor, then 37, was named the Hawkeyes' new head basketball coach. O'Connor's first year as coach, 1951-52, ended with the Hawkeyes finishing second place in the Big Ten. In his second season, the Big Ten commissioner found that O'Connor had violated recruiting rules and ordered him not to talk to any high school athlete for 7 months. The fans thought O'Connor had been singled out for punishment and provided O'Connor with more applause than his players during team introductions. In that 1952-53 season, the Hawks dropped six of their first 7 games, but then caught fire and won 6 of the last 7 to finish 6th in the conference. Then came the 1953-54 season, the first year of play for the Fabulous Five. Bill Shoof, Bill Seberg, and 3 sophomores, Bill Logan, Carl Kane, and Sharm Schuerman. They ended the season 11-3 for the second place in the Big Ten. In the 1954-55 season, the Hawks were Big Ten champs with a 12-1 record and a .448 shooting percentage, the best in the league. They were atop the Big Ten the next year, too. Even better, O'Connor and the Fabulous Five took Iowa into the Final Four of the NCAA tournament, then with 24 teams, in March 1955 and March 1956. In 1955, the Hawks finished fourth in the tournament. In 1956, they were the NCAA national runners-up, losing to the University of San Francisco team anchored by 6'10" Bill Russell, a future NBA Hall of Famer. The Fabulous Five graduated and their jersey numbers were retired. Logan, the center, became Iowa's highest career scorer with 1,109 points in 70 games. In the 3 years the Five played together, they won 35 of 42 Big Ten games. O'Connor appointed Milton Sharm Schuerman, one of the Fabulous Five, as the freshman basketball coach and started rebuilding the team, which finished eighth in the conference. In 1957-58, the team improved, finishing sixth and things were looking up. And then O'Connor died. 4 weeks later, Schuerman was named Iowa's head basketball coach. At age 24, he was the youngest basketball coach in conference history. 10 years after they played, the Fabulous Five reunited the Iowa Fieldhouse on January 22, 1966. A crowd of 11,700 greeted them. By then, Schuerman, after coaching for 6 seasons, had moved on to an Iowa City realty and insurance business. Shoof was selling school supplies in San Clemente, California. Logan worked at the family bank in Keokuk. Seberg was a rancher in Evergreen, Colorado, and Kane was a probation officer in Gardenia, California. That brings me to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, March 24th, 2024. I have been your reader, Sharon Falduto, reading to you from my kitchen table in Coralville, hoping the snow in my backyard melts today. That was a weird snow on Friday. Remember that you can access a recording of this or any other Iris recording at any time on our website, iowaradioreading.org. We do welcome your comments. Thank you for listening.